From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Jeremy, as you know, there's been a flood of reaction to the hunting death of Cecil the Lion. The Minnesota dentist who admitted to killing the beloved lion is being vilified on social media. People are leaving stuffed animals outside his Bloomington office. But there's also a petition circulating calling on officials in Zimbabwe to stop issuing licenses for trophy kills. And we're going to get to those questions about big game trophy hunting today.
Well, first, let's check in on Washington and that looming deadline in Congress to fund the nation's highway projects. If nothing is done by Friday, the Highway Trust Fund runs out of money. Members of Congress are trying to pass a bill to continue that funding, but perhaps not surprisingly, the House and Senate have not yet come to an agreement, with the Senate pushing for a multi-year bill, the House moving towards a three-month extension of current funding. Joining us now is Congressman Carlos Curbelo, a Republican from Florida who serves on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, how are you going to vote on this three-month patch for the transportation bill? Because obviously it sounds like many of your colleagues don't want to do a longer-term fix.
Like everyone else, I'm frustrated. We need a long-term solution for our highways, for our transportation infrastructure. However, the only thing worse than a short-term solution is allowing the Highway Trust Fund to run out of money. So this isn't the ideal scenario. We will continue fighting for a long-term solution, but we cannot allow the Highway Trust Fund to run out of money.
So why not raise the gas tax?
Well, that's an option, and I don't think there's a majority of members in either the House or the Senate that support that option right now, but there are certainly other alternatives to funding a long-term highway bill. We've seen the Senate come up with funding for 3 years in a six-year bill. We think that we could even do a little better than that in the House. Chairman Ryan of the Ways and Means Committee has been talking about the potential of marrying transportation infrastructure with tax reform. Don't know if we'll have time to do that, but it sure would be nice to fund a long-term highway bill without having to raise taxes or user fees on the American people.
So you would not be in favor of raising the gas tax, even though it hasn't been raised in a long time?
If we can do it without raising the gas tax, if there's a path to doing it, I would certainly favor that. I understand the sentiment among many people that say, look, the gas tax has been frozen since 1993. It should at least adjust for inflation. I understand that sentiment. But if we can fund our nation's transportation infrastructure without raising taxes on the American people, I think that's a good option, too.
But isn't the way that that's happening, if you're not going to raise the gas tax, isn't the way that we're funding the transportation infrastructure just simply by borrowing more money?
Not necessarily. We've already seen the Senate come up with 3 years worth of pay fors, including selling oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. There are many ways to fund this bill. Raising the gas tax is certainly not the only way. So if we can find savings and efficiencies in other parts of the budget and move that over to transportation infrastructure, I'm not going to be opposed to that.
But do you think that there is a problem with just these short-term fixes? Because here we are we're going to be back in just a few months worrying about the exact same thing.
Absolutely. I'm not satisfied at all with these short-term patches. We had passed a longer patch here in the House that would take us all the way to December because we felt it would give us time to work on tax reform and use some of those revenues to fill the deficit in the Highway Trust Fund. For me, that's the only reason or the only way I can justify these short-term extensions, as long as we're working towards a long-term solution. I'm confident that before the end of this year, we will have a 5 or 6 year highway bill authorized and hopefully funded.
Congressman, what does it say about your party, the Republican Party, that you control both the Senate and the House and cannot agree on what to do about this transportation bill right now? Because the Senate would like a longer term fix.
Well, look, we may all belong to the same party, but in the United States, we only have two political parties. So there's a lot of diversity within those parties. And in the Senate, we all know that the Democratic majority is significant because we have 54
The Democratic minority, you mean?
The Democratic minority is significant because take 60 votes to get almost anything done there, and there are only 54 Republicans. So it's not as easy as it sounds when we say, well, Republicans control Congress.
And are within the GOP, are you with your fellow Congressman Mark Meadows of North Carolina, who has filed a motion to oust House Speaker John Boehner from his post?
No, I think that's a major mistake. It's a distraction. Look, this Congress has gotten a lot done under Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell's leadership. We've passed deregulation bills, bills to help small businesses, bills to make it easier to fight human trafficking. This Congress has been very productive. And going into the August recess to file this motion, it just seems very selfish, off message, tone deaf. And in my case, I'm not going to allow that to distract me from the important work we have to do here.
Congressman Carlos Curbelo from Florida, Republican. He serves on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, now to the killing by an American hunter of Cecil, the 13-year-old beloved lion in Zimbabwe. It's brought people around the world to tears. Here's Jimmy Kimmel last night.
If you want to make this into a positive, you can... make a donation, support them at the very least.
Kimmel was calling on his viewers to give to Oxford's conservation unit. Scientists there were studying Cecil. He had a collar on. But Walter James Palmer, the Minnesota dentist who killed him, said in a statement he didn't know about the collar. To my knowledge, he writes, everything about this trip was legal and properly handled. Was it? Officials allege that Palmer paid $50,000 to guides to lure Cecil from a protected national park so that he could shoot him with a bow and arrow. The guides are facing charges, and Zimbabwean officials say Walter James Palmer will also face charges of poaching. Jeffrey Flocken is regional director of the North American branch of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. He's lead author on the petition to list African lions as endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. He's a former international affairs specialist for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services and International Conservation. He joins us now. And Jeff, start by clarifying. It sounds like you can't hunt animals in protected parks, but as we're hearing, these parks don't have walls. Animals can get lured out. So what is the legality of hunting lions in Africa?
Well, actually, Robin, it varies from place to place depending on where you go. Different countries have different laws. What is at issue here is in Zimbabwe, hunters are allowed to come and kill their lions, but not in the protected areas. As we all know, animals don't know boundaries. They don't know where the park ends and where it begins. And searching for food or for other animals to reproduce with, they'll leave those boundaries and then they're no longer safe. In the U.S., we do allow currently lion trophies to be imported from other countries where they're killed.
And you mean by lion trophies, the head. And the head of Cecil was severed. I mean, this is uncomfortable for a lot of people. But this was trophy hunting, and that's raised a lot of questions. We hear that there is a divide within the hunting community between people who feel that they hunt for food and it is more ethical, and those who hunt for trophies, as this dentist does and had in the past. What is the ethical divide here?
Well, many legitimate hunters are against trophy hunting of big game. It's a blood sport. It's being killing this animal not for food, not for sustenance, but in fact to mount it and put it on your mantle back home in Texas. Many people disagree with this. In fact, Americans are polled. Over 80% of Americans thought that imperiled species should not be allowed to kill for sport. And that includes lions, it includes elephants, it includes rhinos, species that we know are declining, like giraffes and leopards. All these animals currently can be killed for sport legally and brought back into the U.S. as trophies.
And well, as we said, there's a CARE 2 petition now that calls on Zimbabwean officials to stop issuing hunting permits for trophy kills. That petition has almost 500,000 signatures. But even within the legal hunts, there are people who might see them as being more or less ethical? Explain.
Well, this demand for trophies that is being driven by a very small group of usually wealthy individuals, both here in the U.S. and other areas, is really throwing money at a problem that they sometimes say, oh, well, that money can go towards conservation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, could that money be used in a different way to help save the species without killing it? The idea that killing an animal to save it is the right way to go is an outdated idea. In 2015, there is a tremendous backlash against this because we don't need to kill an animal to save it. There are many ways to work with communities on the ground that live with these animals and work with them to find ways to benefit from the animals by ecotourism or people coming to view nature or take pictures of nature in a responsible way without killing it.
And when I said there were different ways, there are things called canned hunts. They're in small enclosures, which many other hunters say, well, that's not fair. So there's different ways that these hunts take place. The conversation will continue. Jeffrey Flocken, Regional Director of the North American Branch of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, lead author on the petition to list African lions as endangered because their number has dropped precipitously in years. Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As Los Angeles considers whether it wants to try and host the 2024 Summer Olympics, Boston, the city which had the U.S. bid until this week, is reflecting. On Monday, the U.S. Olympic Committee pulled its support for Boston's plan to host the 2024 Summer Games after Mayor Marty Walsh said he wouldn't put taxpayers on the hook for cost overruns. And now the second guessing is on. Did Boston miss a huge opportunity to showcase itself to the world? Or did it make the smart, responsible decision to protect itself from the financial burden of hosting the Games? Boston Mayor Marty Walsh joins us now. Mayor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, back in January, a day after the U.S. Olympic Committee announced that Boston had won the U.S. bid, you said this.
Boston has a vision for a new kind of Olympics, a vision that challenges the norm, encourages creative solutions, that embodies the community spirit that makes the Games what they are.
If you really believed in these Games, do you think you should have fought harder to get the public on board for these and bring them to Boston?
No, I think what happened here was in a couple of days reflection now, when you look at really what happened is what I said in January, I think we were doing, the issue was that we didn't have enough time to be able to put plans together, explain to the public, talk to the naysayers, and be able to convince people on why the movement was good. And there were some missteps along the way as well. I think ultimately what happened here was it came down to the host community agreement. People worried about taxes. People worried about taxpayers' dollars going at the Olympics. People worried about the taxpayers covering overruns and costs overrunning in the Olympics. And I was very clear from the beginning we weren't going to do that. But when I talk about not having enough time, we didn't have enough time to be able to vet it through. And I think if what I said on Monday was said probably publicly, and I'd said it many times publicly, but it's forceful, 6 months ago, it might have been a different situation.
Were you not worried about cost overruns?
No, I wasn't worried about cost overruns. Steve Pagliuca, the chair, put together a very strong fiscal financial plan. And we also had some, we were putting together an insurance policy that would have covered any of the overruns that people were concerned about or that we would be concerned about ultimately as a city and as a in the United States Olympic Committee. But unfortunately, we didn't get to put that plan, fully vet that plan and explain it to people.
So why do you think there were so many naysayers, so many people who did have those concerns in Boston?
I think it was the fear of the unknown. I think a lot of people weren't completely sure what an Olympic movement was all about and how to host the Olympics. You know, you got to remember that it's only been 7 or 8 times in United States history that a city has gone for the Olympics. We've hosted the Olympics in America 5 times, and I think, or maybe 6 times with Lake Placid twice. But people don't really understand what it is, what the Olympics are. And there was some stories from Sochi of the road and some concerns about overruns and what's happening in Brazil. And so a lot of those international stories start to come to the United States saying that the same thing is going to happen here in America.
And you didn't think that that would happen?
No, I didn't think it would happen. I think if you look at 2 international cities, you look at Barcelona and London and what it's transformed those 2 cities, and you look at what the Olympics did for Atlanta and really created unbelievable economic development in Atlanta and helped their city. It helped Utah. And in the 2 failed bids in the United States, most recent being Chicago and New York, there was also tremendous benefit for those 2 cities by pursuing the Olympics and not getting them. There was a legacy factor afterwards where they're seeing growth happening now because of the Olympic conversation.
Well, how much do you think the memories of the Big Dig, this huge project that happened in Boston to put the highway underground, that cost a lot of money, cost more than it was supposed to, took longer than it was supposed to, there were allegations of corruption involved with the Big Dig, how much was that in the back of people's mind as they thought about spending a lot of money and a lot of time on the Olympics?
I think that came up a few times in conversation, and I think that, you know, people, the big dig, I mean, when you think about the project that was there, it was an incredible project, moving, putting the Southeast Expressway, the Central Artery underground, was actually an incredible project, but there were overruns on it, and there was mismanagement on the management level of it that caused tremendous problems, and still, you know, we're still paying for that. And I think that probably idea added to it, but we weren't talking about putting a road underground. This was not going to be a publicly financed project. This is going to be mainly privately financed, and the public financing would have come, ironically, just in the infrastructure and in the security piece of it.
But is the big dig something that you would do again if given the opportunity?
I think absolutely. When you think take a tunnel, if you look at the benefits of the big dig, the aftermath, you're talking about we created open space through the heart of our city. We created, we connected our city. We connected the waterfront to the downtown. I think that if something like the big dig were to happen now, I think I'd obviously I'd downsize the bureaucracy around it. And I would probably, put somebody over the time of the big dig, there were several people that ran the project. You have to have one person that runs the project, and you also have to have insurance to cover any overruns. And clearly what they did with the big dig was a construction marvel. There definitely was problems though with the cost, and they weren't expecting the cost to escalate. When you're talking about millions of dollars compared to billions of dollars, there's a big difference here. And with the big dig, it was billions of dollars of overruns. That was the problem.
What would be your message now to people in Los Angeles, which, you know, you check out the LA Times on a daily basis now, and they are very excited about the possibility that they will be able to bid for the Olympics in 2024. What would you say to the people there?
I mean, I wish them luck if they bid for it. I know that the USOC had told me that Boston was their city and they weren't going anywhere else. But if LA comes into the mix, I wish them luck. I wish them well. One of the first calls I received after we won the bid was I got a text from Mayor Garcetti from L.A. congratulating me and wishing me well. And I would do the same to him. You know, I think that it would be a great opportunity to bring the games back to the United States of America. However, I think the way the rules are currently set up, it puts a United States city at a disadvantage because of that cost guarantee that has to be signed.
Would you support an L.A. bid if they got the bid?
If they get the bid, I absolutely will support them. I'm not going to be bitter towards them. But, I think that the USOC made it very clear to me that Boston was their choice. It would probably make me think a little bit about how committed was the USOC to Boston.
And what do you make of what the IOC President Thomas Bach saying, that the project planning was handled poorly? They're putting the blame on Boston for losing the bid. And Boston failed to deliver on promises. Were there promises that were made that were not delivered on?
Let me just say two things to that. One is the USOC, and there's some great people on the board there, and I don't want to get into a back and forth with them, but they kept raising the bar on Boston all along. And they were raising the bar because the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach's rules, and Thomas Bach's rules and regulations basically were saying to us that Boston and the taxpayers of Boston were going to have to pay for any overruns, or if the games were canceled, Boston would have to pick up the cost. And I don't know about Thomas Bach, but I represent people, and I'm not going to, and the people of Boston, nor me as the mayor of Boston, are going to allow taxpayers' money to be used to fix a problem that they clearly have internally, the IOC. The IOC needs to fix that language there. It's something that the USOC, I know, has some concerns about. The people of LA will have concerns about it. The people of San Francisco will have concerns about it. The people of Washington, D.C. should have concerns about it. Anybody who if the Olympics were to be canceled and that guarantee is signed, that means the city that's hosting that has to pick up every single penny of overruns. I think that's a big problem, and I think that Mr. Bach is you know, in his 2020 agenda to bring a more economical games to cities around the world, better fix that language.
Some of the people who were against the Olympics coming to Boston, people who live here in Boston, have said, okay, we didn't get the Olympics. Now, why don't we make all the infrastructure improvements that would have come as a result of getting the Olympics? What do you think about that? Getting all those things together by 2024?
I agree with them, and I think that's something we have to do. I mean, we're still growing as an economy. Forget the Olympics for a minute, put them aside. By 2024, 2025, our city is probably going to be 700,000 people big. We are probably going to have a lot more economic development going on. We're going to have more companies working here. There's a need for more housing. We have a plan to build 53,000 units of housing. So all of the things that we spoke about the Olympics, we were moving forward regardless. The Olympics were just part of the conversation.
And what about an upgrade of the transit system? Obviously, people around the country remember that over the winter, it really did not stand up to the snow.
Yeah, and that has to happen regardless. I mean, I know that we had a tough winter and the snow really, really added to the disabling of the MBTA. But regardless of snow and regardless of the Olympics, the MBTA is a system that needs to be upgraded. I know that the governor put together a task force and he's working on that, and I support him in moving forward and in fixing the MBTA. I mean, if we want to grow as a city and as a region in the greater Boston area, we need a reliable public transportation system, and that's probably one of the number one priorities that we need to continue to grow as a city and as a region.
Well, how much has Boston's brand been hurt, though, by what just happened? I saw a quote in the Boston Globe. Somebody said that Boston looks like a parochial backwater.
Well, they can say what they want. All I know right now in Boston is that we have over $7 billion worth of construction going on. That's probably one of the largest amounts of construction in the country. Our population is 655,000 people, the largest since the 60s. Our unemployment rate is a little below 4%. We are on an economic high right now. We're moving forward. We have investors from around the world calling at my office regularly looking to invest in our city. We have developers from around the country and around the world wanting to come into Boston. So I think that when you talk about what's happening, if people aren't going to come to Boston because of the rules that we had to live by with the USOC and the IOC, there's not much I can do about that. But I do know that right now, wherever I go, whether it was the Conference of Mayors in September, Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado, or the Vatican in Rome, everybody's talking about how great Boston is.
That's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor Walsh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye, Internet Explorer. Hello, Edge. That's the new web browser, the thing you open up to look for stuff on the Internet, that's being introduced today as part of Microsoft's new Windows 10. And Microsoft is introducing this latest system after a lot of criticism over Windows 8 a few years back, and after the company announced nearly 8,000 layoffs earlier this month. Let's bring in CNN's Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Robin.
So we mentioned a new Internet Explorer system. How else is Microsoft trying to win users over with this new Windows 10?
It's a little bit of old and a little bit of new. This is really an acknowledgement that Windows 8 was pretty much a disaster, a lot of people unhappy with it. So they're saying that there's something familiar here but also fresh. And the familiar is, of course, that start button that, who knew, everyone was so obsessed with and really needed and missed when it was gone. So that will look familiar back in its place with some changes. But there's a lot of new in this as well. Cortana is a Siri-like assistant, is going to be there. You mentioned Edge, which is a faster browser, which will replace Explorer, which a lot of people acknowledge is feeling pretty tired right now. There's also a new gaming system where you can stream games off your Xbox and play it elsewhere in your house. This is really speaking to Microsoft's desire to kind of be seamless and be able to have you move around from device to device. And so that's probably going to strike people as pretty cool. And then some things maybe that are not as sexy but really necessary, security upgraded. This is going to come with antivirus, anti-malware software built in. You won't have to get that extra pay for that extra, and also has things like iris recognition, which is where they see it moving. So there's a lot of stuff that they've refreshed, and it's getting pretty good reviews from people.
Well, and how important is that? We mentioned nearly 8,000 layoffs earlier this month. What's the company trying to do here?
Well, they're trying to retool themselves. I mean, Robin, Microsoft is – we're seeing a world where PC sales are dropping. People are migrating to mobile devices, and Microsoft completely missed the boat on that. They had that disastrous acquisition from Nokia, and the Windows phones just have not taken off, and a lot of those layoffs are centered in that area. And it's acknowledgement by the CEO, Satya Nadella, that that's just not turning out to be successful for them. So they're sort of throwing in the towel, and they're trying to position themselves for the next wave. But I was talking to my colleague David Goldman, who's been following this too. And the risk here for Microsoft, it looks like they have a really good operating system now with Windows 10. So if you've been putting off that PC upgrade for a long time, that is probably good, and maybe you will think about doing it. And if you were moving on to the Internet of Things, then Microsoft maybe is positioned for that. The problem is, what if we don't? What if people stay married to those mobile phones, mm-hmm. and that becomes the control center for everything? Then Microsoft's in trouble. This Windows 10, as good as that may be, won't fix that problem.
Well, especially since maybe they've overpromised. They're telling shareholders that Windows 10 will reach 1 billion users within 3 years, and that would be the fastest adoption rate ever.
I think that is aggressive, but they say there's a billion people using Windows now, so it just means if everybody sort of adopts to the new one, they're pretty far along on that. But 3 years is fast. But listen, they have to have that sort of adoption. And Satya Nadella gets good marks. I mean, he's not the kind of person to overpromise, but I think people are worried. If PCs get replaced, and if we move to this Internet of Things, they can reach that goal. If you're going to stay on your phone, you have no reason to move off of your Android or Apple. That's going to be a problem for Microsoft, and they're going to disappoint. So this is a really good step in the right direction, but I think the verdict's out as to whether this is the strategy that's going to take them forward.
We shall see. CNN's Maggie Lake, thanks as always.
Sure. Thanks, Robin.
It's Here and Now, and look at that. We have magically taken a field trip outside of the studio all the way to Southern Maine. Why? Because that's where Kathy Guntz lives. Kathy, it's great to be here with you on your turf.
I'm so happy to have you here. Welcome to Maine, where the sun's always shining, except for 11 months of the year.
And it's always warm like this, I'm sure, as well.
Well, the people are happy, and the bugs are happy, and the garden is happy.
And the lobsters are happy, too, or maybe not maybe so. Not. But let's talk about the garden that you mentioned here. I'm looking at your beautiful garden over there. Let's take a look.
Okay, come on over. I'll give you a tour. So we have had this garden for close to 30 years. That's about how long we've lived in this house. And we have what I like to call magic soil. I am not that good a gardener, but man, everything takes off.
Everything grows. And how important is soil as you garden?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, if you don't have soil that's got compost or manure and you don't feed it every year, you won't get great vegetables because it loses its oomph, I like to call it, but there is a more technical term to it. We often plant winter crops, which will keep the soil weed-free, and it's been really terrific this year. So, okay, first.
By the way, I feel like I'm in some sort of a Disney movie. There's like a chipmunk jumping around over there. There are butterflies.
You wanted nature. Here you are. Yeah, we cued the chipmunk. Maybe we'll get a bird chirping for you here. But over here, I have a whole bunch of herbs growing in between flowers. I like to mix it up. I've got Swiss chard just starting there, and fennel, and lemon verbena, and opal basil, dill that I'll use for pickling later in the season, and Egyptian onion. So everything's kind of a mushmash. It's not a weed-free, symmetrical classic garden. Does that shock you?
You mean that there are weeds that are growing amidst all of your beautiful vegetables?
No, you're supposed to say, I don't see any weeds. It looks perfect.
I thought that was some great thing. That's something to be proud of, that you have weeds in your garden.
Sure, I'm proud. So anyway, over here, I've got my garlic growing. This is what I planted last fall, and it winters over. And then next to the garlic, we have fava beans, which I adore. They're not quite ready yet, but you see them here. They're the tall green plant, and they have this beautiful purple and white flower that forms before the fava bean comes.
Tell me about these Egyptian onions. What are those?
These are so cool. Someone actually gave us this plant for our wedding, which is over 30 years ago. See, they have a scallion, shallot-like bulb on top, and it gets very heavy, and it droops over and replants. So they're everywhere. We had one plant. Look behind you. They just keep multiplying. They're the weed of the onion family, but I cook with them, so I love them.
That's what you meant by weeds.
Yes, that's it.
It's the Egyptian onion.
Thank you. Good, good, good. We've got all kinds of lettuce and mescaline mix, carrots, scallions, onions, green beans coming up. All of this back here are potatoes. They will be ready very soon.
How much work do you have to put into this, though, to get the fruits of your labor?
It is such hard work. I mean, keeping a garden together is hours and hours, and it's, you know, you got to have a strong back.
But it's worth it to you.
Oh, so much. For me to come out in the morning and pick raspberries off my vine and pull together a lettuce for my lunch and know exactly what was in the soil, that it's completely organic, that no one has sprayed it. The food just tastes so good.
What's the most frustrating one of these plants that you just give it all the love you possibly can and it just doesn't do what you want it to do?
Well, I've had a lot of trouble with the fava beans, but I just keep doing it. John says, my husband says that whole row of fava beans will get 12 fava beans out of it. But yet I still do it. We've had trouble with tomato blight, as have many people in New England, but I would never stop growing tomatoes.
Tomato blight, meaning that some of the tomatoes haven't paid their mortgages and have had to leave the neighborhood and there have been foreclosures.
You're so political. Don't politicize my tomatoes. Actually, Jeremy, what it means is you can see towards the bottom of a few of the plants, they're dried up and kind of crumpled. And so what's happening is that there's a blight that's killing some of the leaves. The hope is that the tomatoes will ripen before the blight gets really serious.
Well, you've got a basket with you, Kathy, and let's pick some stuff.
This is something I've been waiting for, putting you to work. You sit there and you're the big host.
Oh, right.
Now you're going to get down and dirty.
I have to do some
work. I'm going to give you the basket. There's some cherry tomatoes that are red and there are a few gold ones over there. If you'd pick those, why don't you pick a little basil too? We'll throw that in.
Okay. So shall I just snip it off like that?
Yeah, or you could just take the leaf. Yeah, you don't want to
pull the leaf off.
Maybe don't kill the whole plant, okay?
Okay. See, I knew this was a bad
idea. It's good you have a day job.
All right, there we go. Some basil.
Throw that in the basket. Let's go over to the peas. These are the snap peas.
Snap peas.
And I use these here. Just taste these peas. I keep the shells to make a pea stock.
Mm.
Isn't that great?
Oh, they're so great.
Okay, that's the answer to why do you garden? Because you can come out here and just put this into your mouth and it tastes better than anything.
Oh, that's delicious.
Yeah, these are
delicious. So sweet.
Exactly, they are so sweet. So we got a few peas. Now, this is not as easy. I have a wild rambling raspberry patch and I thought we could have some for dessert. So let's go over and pick some raspberries.
I love the idea of being able to pick fruit and not wash it before you eat it.
I know, right? Every morning I get up, I have my coffee and I come out here and pick raspberries and that's my breakfast.
And you've made me a raspberry pie, right?
No, I made you a plum pie.
Oh, I'll take that. Okay.
I was in upstate New York this weekend, and we don't get plums this far north, but there were these beautiful sugar plums and two or three different varieties. So I made you a tart. Hey, I don't get you up to Maine that often. I want you to come back.
I will be back after this.
All right, let's pick.
Okay, well, now we have come inside with our basket and with a few things that we didn't pick on this particular journey, but Kathy, a big basket full of beautiful vegetables from your garden.
I know. Doesn't this look like a still life? Lots of tomatoes from the garden and some big red onions. And then I have about four different types of peppers here from my friend's farm down the street. What I'm going to make for you today is gazpacho, the Spanish dish, which is a cold summer soup. And to me, nothing says summer like gazpacho. It's like a salad in a bowl. I add some fresh basil, some garlic, put it in the food processor. I also add a little bit of bread. And as you can hear, this is two-day-old bread. That's exactly what you want. It thickens the gazpacho. It gives it a body. If it was fresh, it would just drink up the tomato juice and it wouldn't do its job.
You want it to be a little bit stale.
Exactly, but not moldy. So I'll start chopping. Maybe you'll help me. We'll throw it in the food processor and we will have a summer lunch. So I'm going to add my peppers, my tomatoes, my garlic, my onions, my scallions. I'm adding everything to a big bowl. Equal amounts of olive oil and white wine vinegar. Now, it may seem odd to be adding vinegar to a soup, but acidity is a very great balancer, particularly when you have acidic tomatoes and all these sweet, crunchy vegetables. I'm going to toss that up, give it a whirl.
Just throw it in the Cuisinart.
That's it. Everything's been tossed together like a big salad, and we're going to pulse it so we can control how thick or how finely ground it is. And then we're going to taste for balance, salt, pepper, oil, vinegar. Done.
That's it. It's that easy.
Let me just give it a taste for perfect. If I do say
no
that.
Changes necessary.
Seriously, the salt is good. The pepper's good. You could add some of the cayenne if you wanted it spicy. I know that's something that you enjoy. But let me show you how I present it. So then I take all the elements that I've added to the gazpacho. I chop some tomatoes, some basil, some onions, some scallions, and I garnish it. And it's fun to let everybody add their own. I actually find that if you eat this in the middle of the day, it energizes you.
Hmm.
So it's a salad as a soup.
Let's try it.
All right. I'll get you a spoon. Here you go.
Oh, that is so fresh.
So, you know, hopefully you're tasting the garden and you're tasting summer at my house right there in that bowl.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm going to have another bite. Mm.
Nice chew there.
Delicious, Kathy.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Well, we will have the recipes for this at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy, I don't know how we're going to top this next time, but we'll try.
You just have to come back every season.
So far this year, more than 5,000 fires have burned on state and federal lands, according to the U.S. Forest Service. And by the way, that's 10% more fires than last year. But the number of acres burned, 74,000 acres, is 6% less. When a big fire breaks out and hundreds of responders have to be equipped and fed to fight it, fire bosses get what they need from one of 16 regional wildfire supply storehouses operated by the federal government. Reporter Tom Bonsi went to Boise, Idaho, and got a tour of what you might call the Amazon.com for wildland firefighting.
From the outside, it looks like just another warehouse. Inside, the requisite forklifts are stocking and plucking just about everything you could ever need to fight wildfire, except for maybe rain. This complex at the edge of the Boise Airport is called the Great Basin Cache. It's one of the biggest in a national network of wildfire support centers. Nicole Hallisey is an assistant manager here.
And not a lot of people will really think about the logistics that go into making our firefighters successful out on the line. There's a whole army of folks back behind the scenes that maybe aren't getting the press or, you know, getting the kudos.
Hallisey is behind the scenes now. Before, she worked on an elite hotshot fire crew and then later as an air tanker dispatcher.
It's kind of a journey between each warehouse, so it gives you an idea.
She walks me past the millions of dollars of inventory waiting to ship out on demand. The most popular items might surprise you. Number one is AA batteries. More than 850,000 of those went out of here last year, mostly to power handheld radios. Also shipped in great quantities is a pocket-sized 110-page notebook of references and safety checklists.
You know, we all are very good at remembering things, but when we're under pressure, it's always best to have something to come back to.
Hallisey says the checklist booklet, known as the Incident Pocket Response Guide, is now mandatory equipment for wildland firefighters. Also among the other bestsellers are the collapsible water jugs called Cubitainers.
This is one of our very, very popular items, especially the 5-gallon Cubitainer, because no water, no work, as we like to say when we're on the line.
Speaking from experience, she says coffee ranks right up there with water. Fortunately, the fire camp cooks can order the biggest coffee maker I've ever seen, a propane-heated urn that brews 20 gallons at a time.
It's just shy of the size of an old galvanized garbage can.
Yeah, it is. And depending on who's making the coffee, it could taste like it was brewed in a galvanized garbage can.
Another wing of the complex ships out portable satellite-connected weather stations. Electronics technician Justin Dopp says these get sent to large backcountry fires to provide accurate spot weather forecasts.
Usually these weather stations are about the second most important thing they set up. They have to establish communications first. They get the radio techs out there and get the repeater sites set up. And weather is about the next most important thing.
Dopp shows how with a couple taps on a radio keypad, a firefighter can get a personal weather readout from the remote portable station.
Air temperature 73.6 degrees. Humidity 3.2%. Wind speed 4.
In an adjacent building, storehouse staff assemble kits to truck in or parachute to remote fire camps. Those include first aid packages, chainsaws, and food. Hallisey let me peek into an airdrop food box for smoke jumpers.
You've got coffee, you've got hot cocoa mix, you've got some Kleenex, tea, beef jerky, some good Idaho potatoes.
The elite smoke jumpers get an upgrade from regular military rations, which the support center also stocks.
They get to eat like kings more so. So sometimes it's great when you're on a fire and you have hiked into a place where there are smoke jumpers and you can partake in their meals with them.
Fire Cache staff take pride in how much of the gear they send out gets returned for reuse, not including the consumables, of course. Hoses, pumps, chainsaws, and camping gear get cleaned, refurbished, and tested before being placed back on the warehouse shelves for the next wildfire. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsie.